Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you heard the program last week, had a little curveball, something we don't do too often, but when we do, it's fun. The veteran we were interviewing, Glenn Schmidt, was in the middle of his story when we brought in a surprise guest, a former fellow prisoner of his at Stalag 9B in Germany, Dr. William Paschal of Wichita, Kansas. And I mentioned at the time that we might get his whole story another time. And after that, I figured, hey, why not do it the very next week? So today we're going to visit with Dr. Bill Paschal from Wichita, Kansas. Dr. Paschal, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Glenn. Paul?
That's all right. Yeah, we don't have Glenn here this time, but I know that you're going to be plenty for us to handle during this hour. I don't know if we can fit your whole story in during the hour, but we're going to try.
Okay.
And I want to start where I start with so many veterans. I like to take you back to December 7th, 1941, and figure out what you were doing. Now, I know since you're not going to be 85 till October, you weren't old enough yet to go right into the service on December 7th, 1941. You were probably still a young high school student, right?
Right. I was in high school.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about that day? Where were you, and how'd you hear that all of a sudden America was now at war?
I was actually in the high school building when an announcement came over the loudspeaker.
And this is in Kansas?
Yes.
A small farming town in Kansas, right?
Yes, Osborne, Kansas.
And you grew up on a farm?
That's right.
So I'm sure that toughened you up plenty, and you were prepared for everything the Army would eventually throw at you.
I don't know. I didn't know how much they would throw at me, but I was young and somewhat athletically inclined, and I figured that I could handle it, yes.
Did you realize then, when you heard the news about the attack on Pearl Harbor, did you realize at that point that you would probably be in the service before too long?
You know, I really didn't. I really thought that this was some freak thing that would be squashed in a matter of a few months, and it wouldn't interfere with my life at all. And I was wrong.
And you ended up, like a lot of talented young Americans, joining a program that didn't figure to put you on the front lines anytime soon, the ASTP program, Army Specialized Training Program, which was a way to get a pretty good college education while you're working for the military. At least that's what you thought, right?
Oh, that's exactly what I thought. I thought I was going to get an education, being the first in my family to go to college, and I thought getting a commission after this ASTP was through with, that I'd be an officer and a gentleman, but that didn't happen. Neither one happened to me.
Well, and if it had happened, then we might not have quite as much to talk about today. We might not be talking about the fact that Dr. Paschal was a prisoner of war. He might not have received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart. We're going to hear about a lot of that. But you ever sit back and think how things maybe would have been different had all your plans unfolded the way you thought they would?
Well, I have, and I had a great desire to go to college at that time, and I don't know how I would have financed it, but I think in some way or other I would have gone to college and gotten a higher education. Had I not gone into the service, it would have been tough for me to manage it financially, but I was optimistic that I would find some way, yes.
So there you were in the ASTP program at Iowa State University in Ames, and all of a sudden comes word that, ASTP is no longer. We need troops on the ground in Europe. I'm sure they didn't say it quite like that. How did you get the news, and how jarring was that to realize that things weren't the way they seemed?
At Iowa State College, we were called into a convocation one day with the ASTP members. There were about 300 or 400 young men like myself there, and an Army captain got up and executing 90 degree left and right turns, came to the podium and just announced herewith or something like that, this program is abolished, and that really quieted the whispering and the chattering down. But he went on to say that we would be sent to the infantry, sent for basic training, and then for the infantry. Well, that caused a lot of murmurs of disapproval right there, but being resolute and I think somewhat patriotic, why we accepted that in pretty good grace, I think.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking in today's world, if something like that were to happen? What would be the outcry from the participants? But I think every veteran who I've interviewed has told me that the mentality of the country at that time, and I don't think it's just nostalgia when they say that, that the mentality of the country was a little different. And it sounds like the complaining didn't last very long.
No, no, it was just a shock for lasted for just a few moments. But I think, including myself, I think every young man there decided well they would do it, make the be the very best soldier that they could, and regardless of what turned out. And I think that the disappointment I think was over before we filed out of that convocation hall. We were ready for the next step.
And was it a pretty quick process from there to joining the 100th Infantry Division and heading overseas?
Yes, it was. This was about the fourth week of October of December 43. That we received this announcement. They gave us time to go home on leave, like over the Christmas holidays, with orders to report to our nearest induction center and to be sent to offer basic training, which we did. I reported back to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and was sent from there to Fort Benning, Georgia, for basic training, which lasted from January till the end of March of 44.
So you're having to pick up quite a bit in a hurry, and pretty much everybody around you was in the same boat.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Did you feel that what you experienced in that short amount of time prepared you for what you ended up facing once you got overseas?
As well as it could be, we had, I would consider, in looking back, we had real good basic training, and then later when we, when this was over, and I and a bunch of other ASTPers were sent to the 100th Infantry Division at Fort Bragg, we immediately entered a phase of training from April through August of 44 in what they call advanced infantry training, and that was invaluable, very, very valuable. The reason for that is that at Fort Bragg with the division, our advanced infantry training was conducted mostly by non-coms who had already served overseas in Africa or maybe Italy, but these men were experienced. There's no way that you can get experience on your home turf, but it was as good as, it was as close to combat training as you can get.
And once you did get overseas, tell us if you can, the first taste of combat that you had and what your role was in it.
Okay. After my training, basic training, when I was put in the 100th Infantry Division, I was trained and served as an Army Scout. As such, why our duty, or as a scout's duty, why we were to help plot the courses of a patrol, which I did, and also, unfortunately, we were the point man, and the scouts were the point men on when you assaulted a hill. My first day of combat, I wasn't disappointed, but I look back on it as sort of a almost a surreal type of experience. We left our foxholes and advanced on the bridge that was facing us. We opened fire, and oddly enough, a lot of people don't realize this, but when I say we opened fire, we were ordered to fire once we reached the zone of possible engagement. Fire uphill, and every man's supposed to fire two or three clips, whether he had a target or not. This is called suppressive fire, and it causes the enemy to face a hail of bullets coming up the hill at him and duck their heads or otherwise not shoot at us. But oddly enough, when I, as we advanced in going up the hill, we'd take three short steps and drop by a tree or rock and fire. And then, of course, as we get up there, why we see foxholes and to my surprise, I did not see any German helmets. There was only one German that got up and ran to the rear, and I think one of the men in our squad raised his rifle and downed him. But we didn't have a force that opposed us on the first day. And in looking back, I think the reason for that was we were opposing a force of what they call Volksgrenadiers. This was old men and young boys, mm-hmm. and they were not seasoned soldiers. But within the next day or two, it changed dramatically. We had to fight for almost every yard in going up a face of a slope to rout the enemy.
And as a teenager and a very young man, facing a situation like that. I mean, it sounds pretty life-changing and pretty scary and something that would turn your world upside down. Did you just take it in stride because everyone else around you was in the same boat? Or how did you process that? How did you get up the next day and want to go do that again?
You know, in one of the last training sessions before we embarked to go overseas, quite a few of the young men had never been around any violence of that type before, and one of the young fellows in our group raised the question, you know, I don't know whether I can actually shoot and try to kill a human being or not. He along with a lot of others of us were somewhat religious, or claimed to be anyway. And I think the sergeant that was training us that day gave the best possible answer. He said, soldier, where you're going, there's going to be a lot of blood on the ground. Just make sure it's not yours. And at any rate, to make the process there, I think that most of us in the next 2 or 3 days, we kind of made a quantum leap forward and grew up, and we didn't have any problems shooting at what we call the coal bucket helmet. That's the way the Germans' helmet looks to us when we're downhill from it. But we didn't have any problems shooting at that, and as we went up there as a first scout, I was able to see the mound of a camouflaged foxhole, and if I had a real good target, I'd squeeze off some careful shots. And then if I didn't have a good target, if I saw some mounds, but apparently if they were ducked down or something and not looking at us, that meant we had them suppressed. So we would put a couple of shots right over the top of the foxhole. One of the functions of a scout is to find possible targets during an assault, and if I laid on the ground and fired at a certain object, like a mound of leaves that was the camouflage in front of a foxhole, the entire squad would observe that, and the other 11 guys in the squad would fire at the same target. So in that way, we were able to eliminate the enemies one by one, or sometimes two or three at a time. And I think after the initial combat, especially, you get a real change after you see some of your fellow soldiers shot or killed or wounded right beside you. It becomes something that I wouldn't say we were bloodthirsty, but it became that there was no longer any doubters in our squad or company as to whether we could or should shoot to kill another human being. We, in fact, from the ASTP group I was with, almost 80 or 90% of these guys had good reflexes, very good eyesight, and most of us scored expert in the rifle with the M1 rifle. And that means, without going into how great a shot we are, what that basically means is that if we see a target, we can hit it.
And I trust that you did more times than not. And I want to talk to you more about that and some of the things going on around you. We need to take a quick commercial break. But when we come back, we're going to hear from Dr. Bill Pascal about how he earned the Silver Star, how he became a prisoner of war, how he survived, and a lot in between all of that. Dr. Bill Pascal of Wichita, Kansas, our guest today on Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, Dr. Bill Pascal of Wichita, Kansas. If you're wondering what that doctor stands for, he's a retired dentist, but he never would have made it to dental school had he not survived World War II, and more specifically, his time as a prisoner of war at the hands of German forces. You heard a little bit of him on last week's show, sharing how last week's guest, Glenn Schmidt, had inspired Dr. Pascal and other prisoners in Stalag 9B to keep surviving. This week, we're getting his own survival story. You've already heard how he went from a Kansas farm boy to a member of the 100th Infantry Division. He was a scout with that division all the way up until Christmas 1944. What changed on Christmas Day 1944, Dr. Pascal?
On Christmas Day, we were placed in what we call temporary reserve. The reason for that is we had had quite a fierce fight to take the small town of Rohrbach, France. And generally, with the wounded and the wear and tear on of our equipment and depleting almost entirely our ammunition, why, they'll give about a day or two off the line. And so I was, since we were off the line, why, we could get up and walk around without somebody shooting at us. There'd be another company up ahead of us. I was cleaning my M1 rifle, which an infantryman does almost every day if he fires it every day. And I was sitting on a log cleaning my rifle, and the squad sergeant and the platoon sergeant came around, came to me and sat down and began a conversation. At that point, I really thought they came to tap me for guard duty or KP or some other task that was required. But after a little bit of conversation, they mentioned the fact that the enemy had been shooting our medics, our company aid men, because the guys go forward and they may kneel to put a bandage on somebody, and the Germans would shoot the aid man. And I was aware that our company didn't have an aid man at that moment, but the sergeant looked at me and said, "Willie," he said, "you know, we're out looking for volunteers." And knowing the Army way by that time, when a sergeant says that to a PFC, which I was, there's only one thing that's going to happen. So I put the bolt and the trigger assembly back in my M1 and stood up and said, "Okay, I'll volunteer. Where do I go?"
So from there on, you had a different role, but they didn't stop shooting at you.
No, actually, after I volunteered, well, they directed me back to the battalion aid station, and I went through frontline medical school, quote unquote, in 3 days. Probably a record, probably. Then they assigned me to go back on the line with F Company of our regiment.
So a little different group of guys than you'd been spending your time with. But How did that change your perspective going from someone who really is on the front line as a scout? You're out in front of everybody else, you're one of the most vulnerable people, to someone who's trying to care for the guys who have been wounded.
Well, you know, I kind of enjoyed that. I never really was at peace with myself in shooting somebody else, although that had happened a number of times. But I really felt that I was going to be real useful, and I was glad it I felt this was a good opportunity that came along, and I was glad to do that. As a medic, I operated a little bit differently than the other medics had. Most of the other medics would stay to the rear of the platoon with the lieutenant or one of the sergeants, and at the cry of medic, then they would get up and run forward to where were the guys that were shot or killed or maybe killed. But this gives the enemy time to zero in on them and drop them, and a lot of some of our medics were dropped when they were en route to the front guy that's assaulting this hill or to the front foxhole. I didn't feel like that was a very good idea, so when I was out on the line, I always stayed in one of the forward foxholes so that if somebody was needed a medic, they would be to the right or left of me or behind me. If I had to run, I didn't have to run forward. I was closer to my potential patient, I guess you might say. So I stayed in the frontline foxhole as far forward as I could get.
You know, it brings to mind something that my grandfather shared with me once, and my grandfather is kind of the inspiration, well, definitely the inspiration for my work with veterans, was in the medical corps in Europe and had a helmet with a red cross on it, and he told a story of an action where all his fellow soldiers were telling him, "Well, they're not going to shoot at you. You have the red cross on your helmet," and his experience was everything to the contrary. It sounds like that was the case for you, too. You didn't get any free pass for having a Red Cross on your helmet.
No, that's right. Actually, our regular medics that were trained to be medics had this drilled into them, or had this indoctrinated in back in the States, that you're a non-combatant, you don't carry a rifle, and you can treat a man and in complete safety, even if you are exposed to enemy fire. It so happened that when these guys were kneeling or beside the guy that was laying on the ground, they made a perfect target, and an unfortunate number of these guys were shot right through the white circle and red cross on their helmet. And being aware of that, if I had to go to somebody, I crawled on my belly. An infantry soldier learns to advance sometime rather than getting up and running, he'll advance by crawling up on a fortification or a foxhole anyway. And on two or three occasions, I crawled on my hands and belly or made a quick lunge or leap, but I did not raise myself up above the ground too far to give the enemy a good target.
So January of 1945, you've made this switch, and it's only been a couple weeks of you being an aid man. And in early January 1945, you end up being captured. On that same day, your actions led to you being awarded the Silver Star. Tell us about that day, what you were doing, and how you came to be a prisoner.
All right. Due to the Battle of the Bulge, which is about 100 and some miles to the north of us, our official orders were to dig in and not advance anymore. We had gone through the Vosges Mountains, which is very thickly wooded, and we're in the plains of Alsace, A-L-S-A-C-E, France, and this was very difficult area for infantry troops to defend, but I'll back up just a day or two before January the 8th.
Sure.
We had undergone a counteroffensive from the Germans in our territory. It's called Northwind, Nordwind.
Right.
But at any rate, this counteroffensive of the Germans started actually at 12:01 a.m. on January the 1st. And they had had a few tanks and stuff, but in our foxholes, our tanks had been sent north with Patton to relieve Bastogne. And most of us thought, oh, heck, we're in for it now, because we could hear the German armor on the other side of the German line, and we knew they had tanks. Well, let me see. I was out. I had to leave the company on January the 6th to get some new supplies like bandages and morphine styrets. I went back the evening of January the 6th, and that night and the next morning, German tanks overran our position. And so effectively, we were cut off all the day on January the 7th. We didn't get any food or water or ammunition, and it was a precarious situation. Then during the night of 7/8, they made quite a few attacks, infantry attacks at night, which were repulsed. And then at 4:30 in the morning on January the 8th, they mounted what we call a silent attack. There was vigorous firing and fighting going on to the right and left of us on our defense line, but there wasn't any vigorous firing to our immediate front. And as it turned out, this is for a reason. People were alert and watchful, but we discovered that then firing was breaking out behind us, behind our position. They were into the reserve platoon and probably company headquarters or something. But the Germans had successfully, while our attention was diverted to the right and left of the bullets or tracers going through the air, but not in our area, they had successfully infiltrated a skilled platoon through our lines. And our lines were our foxholes were much further apart, because we had to cover a lot of area due to the fact that our tanks had left and some other units had left to go north to reduce the Battle of the Bulge. But it wasn't too great a feat for them to crawl or something between our lines. And most of us were startled and very, very dismayed. We heard German voices behind us. We could hear German burp guns and what they call the Schmeisser machine pistols behind us. And we knew that we had been infiltrated, and at that time the fellows were firing at whatever noise they heard and stuff, which is really, you have to stop and think about that, because you might be firing into your own lines at dark. You're not firing at a target that's 50 yards in front of you. But there was quite a few firing. But about 4:30, I was in the foxhole with a guy by the name of Granville Fuller, and the sounds of the M1s that have a deep, distinctive bark, they had diminished to just one or two or three shots here and there. And so Fuller and I discussed whether Fuller and I thought, well, maybe we're the only ones left alive. Should we get up and make a run for it to the rear? Well, the Germans were already to the rear. If an American foxhole didn't see us running and shoot us, why, the Germans would. We thought, well, maybe we can stay and fight it out. So I asked Fuller how much ammunition we had, and he said 13 bullets.
Whew.
And the final question was, well, shall we fight until we, get wiped out, or shall we try surrender? Why, the two of us, I think, unanimously decided we might try surrendering. So he put his rifle and muzzle first into the snow and jabbed it up and down so he could clog the barrel with snow. We sat there with our hands above our head, and in a few minutes, somebody came tearing up past our foxhole. They probably didn't know where it was because it was almost pitch black. And a body hit the ground just about 3 or 4 feet from my left elbow, from where I was sitting in the foxhole. So I said, comrade here, and there was a grunt of surprise. And so again, I said, comrade here, and a hand reached out, and I guided his hand to my elbow, which to show him that my hands were above my head in a surrender gesture. After I had said comrade, the guy said something in German which I didn't understand, but he reached out and touched my arm, and I guided his hand to my elbow and then up to show him that my hands were raised in a gesture of surrender. And then I took his hand and led it across my body to Granville Fuller, who was in the hole with me, and let him determine that the other man was in the surrender mode also. He jerked on the collars of our coats and made us get out of the foxhole and lay face down on the snow. This man was apparently a platoon sergeant or something, because he barked something out loud in German, and a few other figures showed up in the dark leading American GIs and made them lay down. One of the guys was moaning, and so I asked him if he was wounded. He said, yes, I got shot in the chest. And so I tried to move over to him, being a medic, and the guy that had captured us stood in front of me and pushed my face back down in the snow. And so I said, I'm a medic, and no response. And after about a few seconds, I said, I'm a doctor, which is a term that they understand in the German language. So he moved aside and kind of guided me over there, and I got to this guy, and he said, I've been shot in the chest. So I opened his shirt, raised his undershirt, and I felt an entry wound just about where his left nipple is. And I could feel a crease along there, and I could find an exit wound under his left arm. So I said, the bullet didn't enter your chest cavity. It grazed your ribs, and I think you'll be all right. But laying on the snow and in the dark, I managed to dust some sulfur powder on those wounds and get some tape to stick to his body. And I think we, between the two of us, we used a whole roll of gauze and wrapped a whole roll of gauze around his body and tied it and put his clothes back in order. But anyway, I had to do that while I was practically laying on my face in the snow. But after a few minutes, the German said los, or rouse, something like that, which didn't mean anything to me. But fortunately, one of the captives in the group understood some German. He probably came from a German-American family back in the States, and he said that means go or get up or something. So we stood up, and they started to march us to the rear down a little trail that was in front of our positions, and our own artillery was firing on that trail, what they call a pattern of eights. There would be two shells, one on either side of the trail, and then they'd up their gun sights a little bit and they'd fire two more. Well, our first instinct was to hit the dirt when we heard those shells coming in, but the three Germans that were guarding us, they hit the dirt, and by this time it was starting to get light by the time we moved out so we could see figures and stuff. They hit the dirt, but they pointed their machine pistols at us, and said 9-9, meaning no. So we stood on that trail while it was being shelled. And then after the shelling let up, well, we started marching again to the rear.
What do you do in that situation when your own guys are shooting your way and you're not allowed to duck for cover? Are you just sitting there saying a prayer, or what are you doing?
Yeah, I think almost everybody that was in our group became very religious at that time, if not before. But I personally thought that if they repeat this pattern of artillery shelling, I personally thought that we would be killed by our own artillery. But it was kind of like a sigh of relief when after four or five, I think less than 10 minutes anyway, the shelling lifted and they turned the gun again. Firing on some other target, but they had to be firing blind or firing from a map. There's no way that a forward observer could have pointed out targets to them with that minimal amount of lighting. And so they were firing on pre-selected targets from a map. But anyway, we were very relieved when our guns quit firing.
I can see why, and I'm very relieved too, because otherwise we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. We need to take one more break, and then when we come back, we're going to get the rest of Dr. Pascal's story, his time in captivity, his liberation, and what it means to him today. Dr. Bill Pascal from Wichita, Kansas. Today, it's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've got another 15 minutes or so with Dr. Pascal, who's joining us from Wichita, Kansas today. He was with the 100th Infantry Division during World War II, and you heard just before the break how he was captured, how he became a prisoner of the Germans, how he was nearly killed shortly thereafter by American artillery, but he survived that. He had also survived bullets going through his clothes, shrapnel ripping the pack off his back. You'd had quite a few close calls before you ever became a prisoner, hadn't you?
That's right. It seemed like, every day, we had almost a gun battle almost every day for 60 days, and it was common that I would hear bullets popping past my head and stuff, but I would see guys killed on either side of me or behind me. In fact, my second scout was shot dead when he was just about 3 feet behind me as we were on a patrol, but I'd had quite a few close calls.
And obviously, it took a lot of mind power, a lot of resolve, a lot of resilience to deal with that every day. But I'm sure you never faced a more mentally and emotionally oppressive situation than what you did as a prisoner of war. What? Tell us about that, the uncertainty, not knowing if you were going to survive, how you'd be treated, when this was going to end. How did you deal with being a prisoner?
That was actually quite depressing, I think. I believe I can't speak for all the other guys that were captured, but there comes a time when you're first captured, you feel horrible. You feel like you want to use bare knuckles on the Germans and fight it out. You feel maybe, some people feel guilty for surrendering and not fighting to the last man, I guess. Well, then you get to thinking, well, I can survive. But at Bad Orb, the prison camp where we were, we didn't know it, but it turned out to be, over history, one of the worst prison camps for American prisoners of war in Germany. And in the barracks where we were, it was stone wall about 3 feet up. The rest of the building was one layer of boards. When it snowed outside, it snowed a little bit inside. When we were locked in at night, the electricity was turned off about 4:30 p.m. every day, so it was pitch black in there. They had what they call honey buckets, which is like a half a barrel cut down that you could go to and relieve yourself during the night, providing you could thread your way among 300 bodies lying on the floor. We didn't have bunks. We slept on burlap sack type of stuff that was filled with Excelsior or wood shavings. But you had to wake your buddy beside you, the guy sleeping beside you, if you have to go urinate or anything else during the middle of the night. And because on the way back, you had to call his name, and he would guide you to your spot on the floor. We were packed so tight that if you didn't find your spot on the floor, there wasn't any place to lay. The food was basically almost non-existent. We got some ersatz coffee in the morning during lunch while they had a very thin, watery type of soup. It started out mostly it was made out of green leaves like turnip tops or maybe sugar beet tops, but they did supplement that with a little bit of rye or barley sometimes. And then in the evening, we got three cold boiled potatoes and six. It started out as six men, but later got to be eight men, six men to a loaf of bread. And no recreation. We were just, there were 3,000 Americans in there, but we were based 300 to a barracks, and there's no recreation. You could just go outside and mill around. The situation was so hopeless, it seemed so hopeless, that some of the guys just never even got up and moved around during the day. They just lay, and I think they dreamed of better days at home, and what we call disassociation. They tried to imagine themselves somewhere else other than in a prison camp. And these guys were the first guys to die. And it looked pretty bad, I don't remember exactly when, but one night I heard a strong voice call out, "I am going to recite to you the 23rd Psalm." And this voice proceeded to do that, and then he quoted some other passages from the New Testament and led us in some singing. Well, anyway, all the gossip and, I guess, petty bickering or something, at first there were catcalls and boos, but within a minute or two, that barracks of prisoners of war got just silent, more silent than a church, I think, and people listened intently. This voice, he did this every night, and he exhorted us to not lose hope. Most of the prisoners had turned their thoughts of when we are liberated to the thoughts of if we survive long enough to be liberated, or how long will it take for us to die, like we've seen some of our friends die. But this voice told us not to lose hope. We had to believe in a higher being. We had to take care of ourselves, and we had to get up and mingle. And we urged those of us that were getting them around to kind of look after these guys that were turning their face to the wall and just awaiting death, so to speak. The fact that this voice would do that in this environment inspired a lot of guys. People became more compassionate towards each other. They would adopt their buddies and look out after each other, and people had the hope that they would survive. So actually, this guy, it turned out his name was Glenn Smith, who you interviewed last week, but this guy, I feel, actually saved a number of lives in that prisoner of war barracks. Since he talked at night, and we were so crowded, actually during the daytime, but something, we could go outside during the daytime, I didn't know who was speaking. So I spent about 3 days, I tried to talk to every man in that barrack as I went, and I knew from the sound of his voice from about where he slept geographically on the floor of that barracks. So I worked my way over there, and I found the man with the strong voice. His Glenn Smith from the 42nd Infantry Division, and we had a few conversations during which I thanked him and stuff like that. We didn't really become close buddies at that time, but were acquaintances, and I admired his efforts a whole lot. He's responsible for a lot of the guys getting home safely.
And when you told just a piece of that last week when Glenn was on the program, I wish you could have seen his face, because it was a very emotional moment for him. And to hear you say that was really humbling and touching for him. Now, he was there when the camp was liberated. I understand your captivity didn't end at Stalag 9B. You got transferred to a work camp?
Yes, that's right. Near the end of January, first of all, the Germans called out all the Jewish boys, and then they read a list of other names. I don't know how these were picked, but 300 men were sent off to another camp called Berge am Elster, where they dug tunnels in a mountain to make a place for the Germans to build aircraft parts or engines. While we were in this camp, by the way, our group had been stripped of all of our mess gear, knives, forks, spoons, our razors, our toothbrushes. I ate, washed, and drank out of my helmet. But anyway, at the first week of February, another group of 90 men were called out, and I was in that group. I was the token medic, I guess, without any supplies. They had ripped that off of me. And we were sent to a little town called Treblinka, Germany, about 30 miles south of Leipzig. And this is a strip coal mining country where the Germans used real small steam shovels to remove about 3 or 4 feet of dirt and gravel and exposed a seam of soft coal. And the prisoners with pickaxes and stuff would break this loose and load it into little narrow-gauge cars, and it was hauled off. We could see a unit in the distance, and they heated this to drive off the gases that they would condense into, I guess, gasoline and diesel fuel and grease. And we got the residue in the form of little compressed chunks of leftover coal. It looked like our charcoal briquettes that we barbecue with today. For the first time, we had enough fuel that we could use a stove in this building where we were held in, which happened to be, I think, a former schoolhouse. It was made out of regular double-wall construction. It didn't get as cold, and the situation physically improved quite a bit. However, the men that went out every day to work for the German war machine, I could see their weight dropping very rapidly, but as did mine. But being a medic, except for the first day, they sent me out with them, but I guess that somebody thought that a guy wearing a medic helmet shouldn't be out doing that kind of work. But I and a couple other guys stayed behind at the barracks, and we cleaned it meticulously. There was a guard stayed with us, and he kept us busy from daylight till dark, and that's the same work day that the guys working in the coal mines did. And we started digging the garden for them, and kept us busy. Most of it is in non-essential make work, but in other words, we didn't get to just lay around and enjoy the life of a resort hotel in Germany. We had some unfortunate experiences several days after we got to, and this was called Stalag 4F, by the way. We had some unfortunate experiences one morning while there was one man absent. The Germans would line us up every morning outside, and there would be rows of 10 men and 9 rows. That'd be 90 prisoners. And anyway, it was reported that there was one man missing. So the guards ran back into the building, and the word was passed up the line to me. For some reason or other, I stood at the head of my line. And anyway, the word was passed up that one of the men was deathly ill inside. So I turned and ran. I didn't have any authority to break the ranks, but I ran into the building, and I saw one of the prisoners laying on the floor with a bleeding face. And I started towards him, but they lowered their gun barrels at my belly, and I had to stop. But the captain of the guards, he was actually a sergeant, but we call him the captain of the guards, was putting his pistol back in his holster. And it turned out that this man was deathly ill. He didn't have good color to his face. He had that deathly white color, and he couldn't get out of his bunk, so the fellows that were around him reported to him as very ill to the guards that counted us. Well, the captain of the guards went in and jerked him out of his bunk, stood him up, and started asking him questions, but he was almost comatose or unable to answer, so the guard captain drew his pistol and whipped him across the face a couple of times, knocking him to the floor. But as it turned out that they let him lay on the floor, and they told me that I would receive an ambulance that we could take him to a prisoner of war hospital. The ambulance was a wagon which normally pulled by dogs, a wagon with pretty tall wheels for a little wagon. They used it to deliver milk and cream and eggs to that little village of Treblinka. But they brought one of those, and I and another prisoner and a guard took off down the cobblestone road with this comatose prisoner on it. And we arrived at a hospital. It was run by British prisoners of war about 4 miles away. And we went in, and the British British should know and come, and somebody came out and looked at him, and he pushed the wagon in to some closed-off area and where we weren't, and then he pushed the wagon back out. And so I gave, of course, he had his dog tags, but I gave the British orderly his name and his company. He was from Company F of our division, by the way, and that information. And we had to pull the ambulance back home, but we got word the next day that he had died.
And I can see what kind of toll that takes on you, and obviously you can see that that could be you any other day.
That's right. There were times that I could see that a guy was the fellas doing, because of the work they were doing, if they got sores on their legs, they wouldn't heal. They would just open, and then sooner or later they would fester. And I tried to very desperately to point these out to the guards and keep them off the work detail, but if they could get up and walk, they were on the work detail. And we did have one other guy that was quite ill. I can't remember what the situation was, but he could get up, and he could talk. But anyway, I only batted about 20%, I think, or less. But anyway, I did get permission to keep him off the work detail. So we did I drove the ambulance. That means I was at the top pulling on the shaft of the wagon while the other prisoner pushed from behind. But I drove the ambulance to the hospital once again. We went in and stopped, and the British orderly come out and wondered who we had here. And this guy was laying on the wagon and arrived at the hospital. And anyway, the orderly talked to him, and the guy stood up and gave him his name and stuff. And the orderly pushed him back down on the car and said, "Go home," or something like that. And so I protested. The guy is obviously ill by any standards, but he could function, unlike our first patient. So I protested quite vigorously. I said, "Can he just stay here for several days or a week or 2 weeks? You can feed him or something. At least he's not working." And the orderly said, "Look here, Yank, this here hospital is for the dying. It's not for the living." And that's exactly what it was. If a prisoner was terminal, well, that's where they ended up. And that's all they could do for them is they just record their name and unit and stuff the information off their dog tags and hopefully be able to turn it over to the Allied authorities if and when the war ended in our favor.
Well, what a morbid situation, and certainly a place that you didn't want to end up heading yourself at any time for any purpose other than taking someone else there. So, of course, you didn't know it at the time when you would be liberated, but every day that goes by with you carrying out these duties, trying to help the guys around you, doing what you could to keep your own mindset right. Every day you were getting closer to a day that I'm sure you'll never forget, the day you actually became a free man again. Tell us about how that unfolded.
The air activity over our prisoner of war camp increased a great deal after the first week of March. And I think the reason for this is they could locate an air base on the east side of the Rhine, and it was within range of our fighter aircraft. We saw a lot of air activities after that. On the 11th of April, they rousted us out about an hour early, about 3 or 3:30 in the morning, and told us to bring everything that we could carry, our packs, whatever, and they lined us up out in the yard in the dark, and they opened the gates, and all of us started marching. The reason for that is the day before, we could hear what sounded like a constant roll of thunder, and it actually was coming from the east from Russian artillery. And the guys that could speak German had heard the Germans talking that they were not going to be left behind we weren't going to be left behind, or they wouldn't stay behind to be captured by the Russians and us liberated. They were going to take us, march us to Leipzig, which is 30 miles away. They weren't going to defend this open country anyway because they didn't have the armor. They were going to make a stand at Leipzig. And so we marched a little bit on April 11th. We marched, and they bedded us down in a barn. April the 12th, they marched some more. By the end of April the 12th, at first they started marching us north and to the east, away from any Russian troops that might come. The second day, I thought we were going to go in circles, but we got marched north and to the west. The reason for that is we could hear by 4 or 5 in the afternoon or whatever it was, we could hear machine gun and cannon fire from the west, from American tanks. And anyway, they locked us in a barn of a little farming enclave that four or five houses. And the next morning, to make a long story short, while the tanks came rolling by this area, and the courtyard was filled with Jeeps with machine guns on them, and a bunch of tough-looking soldiers got out and took charge of our guards, and we were liberated at last.
And I imagine there's never been a more welcome sight in your life.
Oh, you know, that was welcome. It was so welcome that most of the prisoners there had to rush up to the soldiers of that armored division and embrace them and thank them. And these guys, they saw our condition. I weighed 90 pounds at that time, and most of the other guys weighed about the same. I had lost a lot of weight. And these guys were digging into their pockets. They were handing out D-bars, which were chocolate bars, fruit bars, and they were handing over their own rations to us, but they didn't have enough right then to feed the 90 fellas anyway. I didn't happen to get a handout, but that didn't make any difference. It was just a joy, and some people were crying tears of joy and loud cheers of hooray and free at last and stuff like that. Pandemonium among 90 liberated prisoners.
And I'm sure in all the days that you had spent in captivity, there were many days where you wondered if you would get up the next day, if that would be it for you. When that moment came, and I guess maybe in the years since then, when you see that all that you've been able to do, going back to school, getting a degree, later going to dental school, and all the patients that you've served over the years, all the lives that you've impacted, when you look back on all of that and the fact that with one snap of the finger, it easily could have been different, what are you most thankful for? How do you account for all of that?
Well, I'm not as religious as Glenn Smith is. I really feel that the fact that I survived the prisoner of war experience, due to the fact that I was asked and either quote-unquote volunteered to become a medic, I think had I had to go to the work phase, I might have been one of the guys that had to be hauled off to that hospital for the dying. But the fact that I survived is the fact that I think I always did feel that we would get out of this. Even back before we went to the work camp, I could see the conditions in Germany. Their motorized equipment back there was driven by these charcoal fuel trucks. They had a burner on the running board, and they had burnt charcoal or fuel in there to make gas for the engine. A lot of the artillery was drawn by horses. And I thought, there's no way that they can win this war with the kind of stuff that they're reduced to. I felt that we would be liberated, or I felt most strongly that we would win the war. I did have some doubts about my own durability to being able to live, but I immersed myself in the day-by-day things and kept abreast of everything. And I guess if you have hope, you can make it. If you don't have hope, why, you're a goner.
Well, clearly you had hope, and I'm very thankful for that. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today. Dr. Pascal, thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit about it.
Okay, you bet. You're very welcome, Paul. I applaud your Hometown Heroes program.
All right, now you're a very special part of it. That's Dr. Bill Pascal from Wichita, Kansas today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.